Ladies and germs, we're back today. We've got another talk. Guess who we got today? The prolific writer, journalist, cool guy, awesome human being, Corey Doctorow. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back on. How are you?
You're very brave for coming back on. Not many people are brave enough. They go, this guy's an idiot. I'm not coming back. So you've written,
I've been on the internet for a long time talking with idiots. It's my specialty. Someone on the internet is wrong, as Randy Monroe says.
Well, God bless you. You're doing the Lord's work there. So is this true? I got to ask you, 238 books. Is that right?
No.
Somebody quoted me 238 books. I thought that's a whole.
No, I wrote 9 books during lockdown, but it's in the dozens.
Okay. So it's true that you've written 97,000
like
books?
Below 3 dozen, above 2 dozen. I don't know exactly how many. Okay. I'd have to count.
All right. This is what I get for trusting ChatGPT. So you've written a few books this year, and I just got a taste of the first one, which, let's talk about that one first, because this was totally up my alley as far as the characters involved. You had, you're talking about Chuds in the not-too-distant future, is that right?
Chuds?
Like, you
not
know...
Not really Chuds.
Well, these anti-immigrant sort of geriatric old guys that...
Oh, so Chud is from a movie. It's like corrupt human underground dweller or something.
Oh yeah,
it's
no,
from
not
a, from
the
an
80s.
Old movie.
Yeah. No, not the 80s Chud, like the nuanced new Twitter Chud, which is just slang for
Oh, I see.
It's like
it's a book about the people who lose the just revolution to transition to a Green New Deal. So and what happens, because I mean, there you are in Germany. People who lose a just war do not dig a hole, crawl inside, and pull the dirt down on top of themselves. They're still around, and Truth and Reconciliation takes you so far, but not all the way. See AfD Day. I think we spend a lot of time imagining a climate apocalypse where those people are in charge, but I don't think anyone had ever written a climate apocalypse where those people were the counter-reformation, right? Where they were the losers, but still around, because they're not going to disappear. And, you know, a movement that is oriented around changing the status quo, like the movement we have today to do something about the climate emergency, may not find it easy to become defenders of a new status quo when they win. But those are foundationally different stances. This book kicks off at this moment where people are quite hopeful, not because the climate emergency has been averted. We have locked in place certain catastrophic events in the future, but they don't have to be disasters, right? The seas are going to rise. The zoonotic plagues are going to be triggered by habitat loss. There will be wildfires and floods. But the thing that separates those from disasters is whether we prepare for them and cope with them gracefully, or whether we continue to insist that all of these are a series of one-off incidents that we shouldn't make any serious remediation for. And so this is a book in a world where they're like relocating coastal cities inland all over the world. Millions of people have put their backs into that project, solarizing, weatherizing, building permanent accommodation for refugees, both internal and transnational, who've lost their homes to climate emergencies that have rendered parts of the world uninhabitable for the long term, and in which they're reorienting their lifestyles around a high-tech, responsible relationship with both material and energy. We've historically treated material as though it were abundant, used it once and thrown it away. And we've treated energy as though it were scarce, particularly when it comes to building things using the extra energy needed to make sure that they can gracefully decompose back in the material stream when we're done with them. We don't want to use that energy because the material is abundant, the energy is scarce. The reality is, you know, we get a fresh supply of energy every time the sun rises, and we get another delivery every time the moon comes up. We don't get new materials unless like a meteor survives atmospheric reentry. you know, if we were to capture 0.4% of the sun's rays that penetrate the atmosphere and reach the Earth's surface, everyone on Earth could have the energy budget of a Canadian, which is like an American energy budget, but colder. So, you know, it's a very amazing way of thinking about the future, but it requires that we really think hard about what we're going to do with our materials. So they've embraced things like library socialism, where instead of living a foundationally impoverished material life, where everyone like me, you know, I own a house, I live on the outskirts of Los Angeles, and I have to make holes in my walls a couple, three times a year. So I have a drill I call the minimum viable drill that sits in a drawer here. It's like the economically rational drill for me to own, but like its most salient feature is it doesn't explode into white hot shrapnel every time I use it. There's not really any good reason for me to own that drill. The fact that everyone in my neighborhood owns that drill for themselves is not a mark of material abundance and comfort any more than a world in which everyone walks around with their own roll of toilet paper because the toilets don't have toilet paper when you need them is a world of abundance. Even if there is enough toilet paper for everyone to have their own roll, that is not an abundant world. That is a worse world. And so this is a world where there's a kind of stochastic cloud of location-aware, use-aware drills that are engineered in non-market ways to gracefully degrade back in the material stream when they're done. They're extremely high quality. They gather telemetry about their use so that the next drill that's made is better. You can always find a drill when you need it, but you don't need to own a crummy drill or a crummy lawnmower or any of those things that you use once a year, Christmas dishes or whatever. They're just sort of in a cloud that's provided as a public good by a well-organized society. And so this is all like a very cool way to live, right? It's a world with severe challenges, but it's a world without the terror of not facing those challenges. And in that world, there is a political counter-reformation. After 8 years of a transformative presidential administration, 4 years of that president's bumbling vice president being the president, and then a complete turnaround, we now have far-right government back in the United States. It's funded and backed by a coalition. You have the farmers and the turkeys they convinced to vote for Christmas. So the farmers are offshore billionaires who fled when we instituted extremely high taxation for the top decile of wealth and took to the seas in a kind of Neal Stephenson LARP of cruise ships and aircraft carriers and super yachts circulating the world's oceans, trying to convince poor people to use Bitcoin.
Wrote nonfiction a little early. That's all you did, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's based on people who really want to do this. They're just so profoundly stupid and self-destructive that if they tried, they'd just eat each other. And then their useful idiots are you know, white nationalist militias for whom the fact that their material needs are secured is a nightmare, and who think that they're somehow the U.S. government can run out of dollars, and when the U.S. government spends dollars, that those dollars have to be repaid, as though the U.S. was not the place where the dollars come from, as if dollars don't come from typing zeros into spreadsheets at the Fed, and as though dollars come from taxes, not the other way around. It's very weird that people think that our taxes fund the government, given that the government creates the money, right? That's like saying your Starbucks gift vouchers create the lattes, right? And without the Starbucks gift vouchers, they couldn't make lattes. Starbucks makes the gift vouchers, right? If they require more gift vouchers in order to produce a latte, it's just an integer, right? They can come up with another integer, declare it to be a gift voucher, and make it. Starbucks has constraints based on like how many baristas they have, how much milk they have, and how much beans they have. But gift vouchers are not their constraining thing. And the US government has constraints about how much resource it can command and how much labor it can command and what happens when it competes with the private sector. But dollars are not a thing the US government needs. We need dollars, right? The US government doesn't need dollars any more than Starbucks needs, you know, latte gift certificates.
These are citizen coupons just to keep us alive, yeah.
Yeah, we have this money story objectively wrong. You know, the historians and the anthropologists tell us that it never happened. There's the money story that says we used to trade cows for chickens, but it was hard because unless, you know, you wanted exactly one cow's worth of chickens, then they'd have to make change somehow. and that didn't work. So we all spontaneously chose gold, and then the government started to take our gold away. And that's completely backwards. First we had like ledgers, right? You had like Babylonians who just recorded like how many bushels of grain you owed to the people who advanced you the seed and the labor and whatever. And then you'd make good on it once the grain came in. And then you had like Bronze Age conquering armies that needed to provision themselves. And so rather than the emperors like set up supply lines where they were sending food forward to the imperial periphery, they just charged the imperial subjects a tax in coins that were stamped with the emperor's head, and they paid the soldiers in those coins. And at the end of the year, if you didn't have the coins, they burned down your farm. And so when the soldier said, I will give you some coins for the product of your farm, you would happily accept it. And then everyone who supplied your farm would also happily accept it, because there was always a farmer who needed the coins to pay the tax, right? That's where money comes from. Yeah. The term revenue means coming back, right? Like, it's when the government brings back the money it issued. It's not money that the government is making. It's money the government is recalling. Governments can run deficits. That just means that they put more money into the economy than they took out that year. That's good, right? If the economy is growing and you have the same amount of money, then people have to borrow or do other things that are super inefficient in order to get the liquid cash. And governments can run surpluses, which is when they take money out of the economy at a greater rate than they're putting it back in, which I guess if your economy is contracting is fine. But if your economy is not contracting, it's bad, right? It basically crashes your economy. This is why austerity is really bad in times of economic contraction, is it accelerates contraction. But, you know, this idea that like governments print too much money and then prices go up is really backwards. Like in Weimar, the prices went up and so governments printed money. Right, the prices went up in Weimar because Germany had to send gold to France and England in World War I reparations every year at a rate that exceeded the amount of gold they had. Ooh. And so you had bidding wars for things that were intrinsically scarce. And because of that, the prices of everything went up. And they went up so fast that it wasn't even that the German chancellor was printing the money. They actually, like, merchants could not make payroll during Weimar hyperinflation because there wasn't enough money in circulation to pay their workers. And so large merchants were entitled to print their own money. Like department stores used rubber stamps to make new Deutschmarks, right? It was the prices that went up and the money supply that expanded to fit it, not the other way around. And this is just like empirically true. Like all of those facts are true that, you know, Germany owed more gold than they had. Prices went up because of that. The money supply was created at the margins because there was a shortage of paper money as prices went up. You know, we could argue about like the interpretation of these facts, but those things are in fact facts. They're not really up for dispute. So anyway, this is about weirdos who get convinced, as so many of us are, as so many Germans are, that if you spend more than you tax, you destroy your economy, when in fact spending more than you tax is a thing you absolutely have to do if your economy is growing. Otherwise you end up with just like deflation, and then nobody wants to spend money. Like if a euro is worth twice as much tomorrow as it is today, why would you spend it? Right? Just like anything you could you discretionarily need to spend, you should just wait, right? And then the entire economy goes into vapor lock because nobody wants to spend money if prices are going down.
They just
wait as long as they possibly can. Yeah, well, it's another kind of austerity, right? So like printing money is neither good nor bad. You should just make enough money to provision the public purpose. And sometimes that public purpose requires that you do what's happening in this book, which is do a whole shit ton of infrastructure spending, right? Like educating people, building roads, building factories, building railroads, remediating Superfund sites and so on. All of these things increase the supply of goods that are for sale and the services that are for sale within a government's territory and make them available for governments to procure, right? You can only procure things that are for sale in your money. But like if you build a energy plant, then energy is now for sale in your money, right? If you create a solar panel plant, then now solar panels are for sale in your money, and governments can buy as much or as little of the solar panels that are being built within its borders.
Sounds like the future has a bit of a Marxist flavor to it, you know, out of necessity.
Well, Marxists aren't. This is Marxist adjacent. It's called modern monetary theory. There's lots of Marxists who are modern monetary theorists and lots of Marxists who don't believe in it. But definitely, like, I do believe that reality has a completely unfair leftist bias. And that I, you know, I'm sorry for my conservative friends that they have to deal with that. But certainly, yeah, like the idea that states can do things is definitely a part of this future, and that things that markets aren't good at shouldn't be done is not an orthodoxy that I think will take us to a sustainable future where most of us survive. I think if we only do things markets are good at, we'll all be dead. So there's definitely things that are done in non-market ways. But you know what? There is like a, not that they're my friends or anything, there is a current on the right now that believes that. There's a whole bunch of trads who are, you know, into doing things like creating unions and reigning in monopolies for completely different reasons. Some of them are hyper-nationalists and they want to create national capacity. And so they're willing to pursue industrial policy. Some of them are like other kinds of trads, like they want to return to one income nuclear family households. And to do that, you have to increase wages presumably male breadwinners. But there's like a burgeoning current, and you know, like Orban and Trump and those people, they're not like not part of it. They're not the center of it, but they're within that current. There's a whole bunch of these weirdo trads who are like anti-corporate. They're like pro rich guy and pro oligarch, right? They're just anti-corporate.
Weird. Don't the two go hand in hand? I mean,
they can, but they're not. There are forms of rich guy that exist without corporations, right? Like kings, right? Kings are rich guys who exist without corporations, you know?
And they're great, you know?
I mean, this is a thing that I think when leftists go, you know, all forms of oligarchy are the same and all forms of extractive economics are the same. They miss important nuances that are important not just like intellectually, but because they represent fracture lines in our adversaries' camps. Mm-hmm. So Yanis Varoufakis wrote a really good book last year called Techno-Feudalism, where he distinguishes feudal from market economics. And he says, look, you know, like feudal lords, they owned land and there were peasants who were bound to the land and the peasants owed them rent. And that rent was not subject to competition. If the next lord's peasants were better at working the land, your rent didn't go down. And you made money no matter what, and workers had to work for you, but they owned the means of production, right? Like, in fact, that was an advantage. Just like, you know, Uber drivers have to provide the car, peasants had to provide their agricultural implements, but they still owed you rent no matter what, right? And that is distinct from entrepreneurs, capitalists, who provided capital, demanded the end of peasants being tied to the land because they wanted peasants to be proletarianized, kicked off the land, and therefore forced to seek wages in factories, and who wanted to turn the land over to industrial inputs, sheep for textile mills. They were the enemies of the landlords, right? Early capitalist theorists like Smith hated landlords because they saw the landlords as like the a drag on entrepreneurs. Landlords are anti-growth, right? Landlord growth comes from conquering other territories, right? It doesn't come from improving production. Capitalist growth comes from improving production. Both of them extract the fruits of that growth from labor, right? But the capitalist wants the laborer to be more efficient, right? Whereas the landlord just wants to get their rent. If you own like a cool corner storefront in like the Kreuzberg, and you have a cafe that pays you rent, and another even cooler cafe opens across the street and drives your cafe out of business, your tenant's cafe out of business, right? You as the landlord are now better off because your shitty cafe tenants are out of business and you can rent that storefront to someone who's really excited to sell, I don't know, upcycled like vintage denim to people who are in line for the cool coffee shop, right? landlords, it's heads they win, tails you lose. Entrepreneurs are at each other's throats. Every entrepreneur wants to be a landlord, right? Every entrepreneur would like to switch from making profits to making rents.
Sure.
Because competition keeps you up at night. You know, landlords get to buy red trousers from the...
Yeah, landlords are the ultimate parasitic thing, while capitalists still might treat their employees well to keep them going for an extended period of time.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that too, but no, but it's just that landlords are not... landlords aren't subject to competition. That's the key insight. Mm. Is rents are incomes that are not independent of competition. And of course, every economy has both rents and profits, right? Like there were people who bought and sold things and made things in the feudal era, right? The distinction between a feudal society and a capitalist society is not whether there are landlords and whether there are industrialists or entrepreneurs. The distinction is what happens when they come into conflict. That's what tells you what kind of society you live in. So take the Eastern District of Texas, where the patent trolls set up their fake headquarters and then sue giant tech companies for fake shitty patents, right? You know, I have a patent on, tapping a phone screen, right? And then I'm going to sue Samsung over it. Well, Samsung is mostly their capitalists, right? They make things. The numbered LLC with a shitty patent headquartered in a post box in a dusty, empty building in the Eastern District of Texas, they're a rentier. They're a rent extractor. When the patent troll sues Samsung, if the patent troll wins, that is a victory for feudalism. And if Samsung wins, that's a victory for capitalism.
Interesting.
I'm not saying that either one is better for workers or better for society. But if you want to transform a society, you need to know what it is. You need to know where its fracture lines are. Hmm. And so, the lost cause is a world in which you have rentiers, would-be feudalists, who are masquerading as capitalists. Bitcoin is a very feudal grift, right? Because the idea of Bitcoin is that early adopters amass portfolios of coins, and then other people, once the coins are adopted as a form of currency, which is to say a store of value, a unit of account, and a unit of exchange, once they're adopted as currency, then you have to procure your Bitcoins in order to do business in the world. Right. And so you have to buy the Bitcoin. So in order to do, so imagine if instead of dollars flowing into the economy by the U.S. Treasury writing checks to government contractors and employees and then them filtering out from there and people on benefits and whatever. Imagine instead if like you had to just to you had to trade things of value in order to get your money, in order to get things of value. Right. Like, If before you could spend money, you first had to do some work or give something away to a feudalist whose role in the economy was to own a portfolio of Bitcoins, right? That's a feudal arrangement, right? That's the Web3 vision, right? It's like the internet now, except doing anything costs pretend money, and you can only get the pretend money by giving someone real money. So first you give someone real money, and then they give you the right to go and do stuff, right? Click your mouse, right? Mm. That's Web3. It's an internet where you pay rent to do stuff.
It's a kind of dystopian middleman between you and trying to just live your life and make exchanges of goods and services.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with intermediaries. The difference between an intermediary and a rent seeker is about capacity. So, you know, in The Internet Con, which is the other book I wrote recently, you said Lost Cause is the first of the books I wrote during the lockdown. It's the fourth of the books I wrote.
Jesus criminy.
So the first one was How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism, then Choke Point Capitalism, then Red Team Blues.
You must have calluses on your rear end, I swear, just at that keyboard all the time.
Yeah. Well, I hang on the hammock most days. I only sit in my office for Zooms. But I live in Southern California. It's good for that. So this is like the Internet Con, I think, was the fifth of my lockdown books. And then that my sixth lockdown book was Lost Cause. So the Internet Con is about how the internet transformed into five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four, and how useful intermediaries became rent seekers. Because intermediation is fine. You know, when we were like, oh, we're going to disintermediate the world with the internet, what we meant wasn't that we were going to get rid of intermediaries per se, right? Like that, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Toronto, there was a writer I loved. He was a street author called Crad Kalodny. It was his pen name. And he would stand on the street selling these books he wrote and printed and bound himself. And he would wear a sign around his neck that said, "Very famous Canadian author, buy my book." Or sometimes he just had a sign that said, "Margaret Atwood." and you know, God bless Crad. He was amazing. He would secretly record drunks that harassed him and sell cassettes with best ofs. Of his like snappy dialogues with weirdos in the middle of the night on the sleaze strip outside the strip bar. Like he was great. He was just great. But there are authors out there with things to say who are not capable of doing that. And I'm okay with there being like booksellers, distributors, editors, printers, typesetters, proofreaders. Like those are fine. And the difference between those being intermediaries and being rent seekers is how much power they have. And what has happened is that the intermediaries of the internet amassed power. They amassed it first by being able to trample our historic competition laws. Historically, we didn't let companies buy their rivals, and we didn't let them fence new market entrants out by selling goods below cost. So think about Uber. You know, they lost 41 cents on every dollar they made for 13 years. They set $31 billion on fire, mostly money from the Saudi royals that was funneled through SoftBank's Masayoshi Son and the Vision 2030 fund, which is a hilarious thing. So they called it the Vision 2030 fund because it's like the thing they were going to do to Saudi's economy by the year 2030, but also because like it's like 2020 only better, except 2020 vision is good and 2030 vision is bad. Like it was very funny that was what they put, you know, $80 billion into. Great. So anyway, you know, they lost 41 cents. Yeah, so they lost 41 cents on every dollar of every ride, and that meant that like every taxi company went into business, and all the other rideshare companies went into business, and people stopped taking public transit, and government stopped investing in it. So you know, like that used to be illegal too. That predatory pricing, now it's legal. So we used to stop companies from buying their rivals. We don't. We used to stop them from predatory pricing. We don't. Now you have five giant companies running the internet, right?
Did we ever do vertical integration? Was that ever illegal? Because I know that the oil companies did it.
Yeah,
but
100%. Yep. Yeah, like the reason IBM didn't make its own parts and operating system for the PC is because the DOJ's antitrust case against IBM that went from 1970 to 1982 was in large part about vertical integration and tying. And you know, after that lawsuit, which ended with IBM victorious, they outspent the DOJ every year for 12 consecutive years. They spent more on lawyers to defend themselves from just the DOJ lawyers working on their case than the DOJ spent on all the lawyers pursuing every case that the DOJ was working on for 12 consecutive years. They called it antitrust Vietnam. And they waited out, you know, successive presidential administrations until Ronald Reagan just halted the case. But even so, they were so shaken by this long, bruising fight that when they made the PC, they were like, someone else is going to make our parts and someone else is going to make our operating system. And then when Tom Jennings, who was this great, is this great hacker, nerd, anarchist guy, published a great zine called Homo Core. He was hired by what was the name of the company? Phoenix. He was hired by Phoenix to clone their ROMs, which is how we got the, you know, Compaq and Gateway and Dell, was they bought Phoenix ROMs. And IBM just didn't go after them. They were just like, ugh, you know, the last thing we want is to have the DOJ back in here. Like, it's just, you know, don't make the DOJ mad.
Wow.
Right? So yeah, we used to prohibit vertical integration. And so once the sector got super concentrated, it captured its regulators. Right. So capture is not just like a matter of being a big firm or a big industry. You have to be a unified industry. Right. If the industry is a rabble, like if half the industry wants one thing and the other half the industry wants the other, they cancel themselves out. But when everyone speaks with one voice, they get what they want. So like back in the Napster era, entertainment was like seven giant companies and tech was like a couple hundred medium-sized companies. Those couple hundred medium-sized companies were an order of magnitude larger in aggregate than entertainment, but entertainment just kicked their ass because entertainment spoke with one voice in every forum. And the tech sector, they couldn't even agree on like how to cater a meeting where they would discuss what their policy would be, right? And so they just lost and lost and lost. And now, you know, they're so inbred, they've got a Habsburg jaw and they've won every one of their regulatory priorities. So like on the one hand, they don't get regulated. They can violate your privacy. They can violate your labor rights. They can violate your consumer rights. And they just say, oh, we did it with an app, so it's not a violation. Right. You get this with GDPR non-enforcement against Google and Facebook. You get it with the failure to enforce labor law against Uber, which does this thing called algorithmic wage discrimination, which is where they pay drivers who are more picky a higher rate per mile until they become less picky, and then they pay them a lower rate. This is just all done algorithmically. And if you become more picky, the rate goes back up again. And so this is a way to like get you to give up whatever your side hustles are that let you be a picky driver and become totally dependent on Uber. And then they just drop your wage down to starvation wage and, you know, it's too late. You've given up everything else. So, you know, that's illegal, right? In other circumstances, but tech can do it. And, you know, one of the reasons they can do this is because tech is different. Like there are some exceptional things about tech, although tech exceptionalism per se is not good. Like tech is very flexible, right? Like the most kind of wicked coal boss that Tennessee Ernie Ford ever sang about would have loved to have paid his miners differentially based on this kind of algorithmic oversight. He just didn't have enough clerks and green eye shades to like change the payroll from minute to minute, right? It was just like too cumbersome. So tech has got this like nimbleness. Now, hypothetically, that cuts against tech. Like hypothetically, you could have a bot that filters out all of the Amazon pay-for-play items. So, you know, the if you click the first item on an Amazon search, on average, you pay 30% more than the best deal on Amazon, right? Because that's a paid spot. If you pick out of the first two rows, I think it's on average 20%. You have to go, I think, an average of 17 spots down before you get the best deal on Amazon. Amazon makes $38 billion a year charging for pay for placement, right? So you could make a bot that just like crawls Amazon and figures out what the good deal is and filters out the algorithmic pricing stuff and whatever. You know, drivers could build like effectively an app-based union where they automatically all refuse Uber rides until the price per mile goes up. It just connects all their phones and doesn't allow rides. Or drivers and riders could have a second app on their phone, and when I page an Uber, it would check to see whether we both have that app on. That would be like a co-op app, and if we do, it would tear down that ride as an Uber ride, cancel it, and rebuild it as a co-op ride where we just cut Uber out of the loop, right? Like there are all kinds of things we could build, but this is where tech's capture comes in, because not only have they managed to get tech under-regulated, they've also gotten it over-regulated. So that kind of reverse engineering, scraping, bots, all of that stuff, when deployed against tech, violates an entire raft of laws. Article 6 of the European Copyright Directive of 2001 bans reverse engineering to access a copyrighted work like the software, you know, in an app. And so just removing the encryption so you can change how the app works or analyze it is itself a crime in Europe. In the US, the version of this law is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 1201, 1998. And it provides for a $500,000 fine and a five-year prison sentence, right? So Jay Freeman calls this felony contempt of business model. If you design your device such that using it in ways that your shareholders disprefer involve violating terms of service or bypassing a digital lock or doing one of these other sort of very normal things that all these tech companies that are giants now used to do in order to get to where they are today, you know, they can send you to prison, they can fine you, they can put you out of business. And so you have these three forces working together. You have a lack of competition. That lack of competition creates regulatory capture, which means that there's no constraints on how the flexibility of digital can be exploited by incumbents. And there's full constraint on how new market entrants, consumer groups, individuals, and workers and change those apps and services back so they wrestle value back from the manufacturers of these. You combine those three and you get this degradation, this platform degradation. I've been calling it inshittification. You get inshittification. And, you know, this suggests, like, that analysis suggests exactly what you do to make it better, right? You restore the traditional contours of competition law, which is going really well. You have, you know, Breton and Vestager at the European Commission and Kahn at the DOJ and Jonathan Cantor at the, or Kahn at the FTC and Jonathan Cantor at the DOJ and so on. They're all doing amazing work, fighting mergers, breaking up companies, revising merger guidelines, like just doing a bunch of stuff that we haven't done for 40 some years. And that's like long overdue.
You really think that there's going to be, this is like the latest and greatest in trust busting since Teddy Roosevelt.
Oh yeah. I mean, it is empirically the largest surge in competition law enactment and enforcement since the Carter administration.
Oh, good.
Right? Like there just hasn't, and it's global. It's like, this is not like something some, they call us hipster antitrust people, the neo-Brandeisians cooked up in America and the bowels of the Democratic Socialists or something, right? Like there's a breakup bill targeting Google and Facebook called the America Act going through the US Senate right now, whose two sponsors are Elizabeth Warren and Ted Cruz. Right. This is not like a, you know, fringe democratic socialist line. This is like mainstream of the right and the left. And it's like in Europe and Canada, which has never had a fit for purpose antitrust law, just announced that for the first time in Canadian history, they're going to add an abusive dominance standard to, which is just basically like exactly what it sounds like. A company that is dominant and abuses it was not illegal in Canada. Right. Now it's going to be illegal, right? Australia, the UK, the UK has got a bill in Parliament now to finally give powers to the Digital Markets Unit at the Competition and Markets Authority, which is, you know, their antitrust regulator. And the DMU, the Digital Markets Unit, is the largest technical unit of any antitrust authority in the world, 70 full-time engineers on the government payroll. But they never got their enforcement powers because, like, Brexit just derailed the agenda, like laws. Just a bunch of bills died on the order paper and continue to die on the order paper because the government is so shambolic.
Well, they finally introduced it. How are the capitalist class not going to fight this? Like even Warren Buffett says that his secretary doesn't get paid enough or whatever. Are they going to fight this or are they going to just lay back?
Buffett loves monopolies. Whenever Buffett talks about his like remarkable and alarming priapism for durable moats and walls, right? Capital moats and walls. That's just a fancy way of saying he only wants to invest in businesses that no one can compete with. So he's a rentier, and so he's not going to stand for this stuff. He hates it. But you know, the people who aren't invested in monopolies are not happy about this, right? Like the people whose businesses are being clobbered by monopolies are really fucked off about this. Like the capitalist class is not benefiting from this.
Oh, that makes right? me happy. It's like
and remember, the job of a monopolist is to extract rent, right? So people who see themselves as capitalists don't like rentiers. Right. They're so this is the fracture line. Like when people say, oh, well, you know, capitalists, feudalists, it's just word games. They all make their money from workers. Sure, they do. But, you know, what stops unions from forming? Monopolies, because the other side of a monopoly is what's called a monopsony, which is when there's only one buyer for a good, like labor. When there's only one buyer for labor, it's very hard to discipline them with organized labor force. When there are lots of shops you can go to, when there are rival shops, then it creates discipline on the labor, not on workers in the labor market, but on buyers, employers in the labor market, right? This is why bosses love non-compete agreements and trade secrets and all these other things that stop workers from changing jobs and create indenture, right? So, you know, I'm not going to pretend that capitalists are our friends when we fight feudalists, but what capitalists want is opening the space for the surge in trade unionism that we're getting now. Like these two things are moving,
so when
as lawyers say, mutatis.
So when these right-wing people,
they're moving together.
These right-wing people started talking about how they get actually on top of corporate welfare, and then I'm like, oh shit, I actually agree with you there. And you think,
yeah,
will that open up the thing for small businesses again? Will we see like the rejuvenation of Main Street if we, adopt that idea?
Yeah. Firms are disciplined by four things. Tech firms are disciplined by four things, right? They're disciplined by competition. They're disciplined by regulation. So competition is the fear your customer will go somewhere else. Regulation is the fear that the fine will exceed the profits from doing something bad. They're disciplined by self-help. So in the tech world, if you make your ads, like if you're like, okay, we're going to make the ads 10% more obnoxious and it's going to get us 10% more revenue. If that prompts 15% of your users to install ad blockers, the change in your revenue from those users is not static. It's not like you don't get the additional 10% that you're expecting to get from making the ads more intrusive. The lifetime permanent revenue from those users is zero from that moment forward, right? Because once they've got the ad blocker, you just can't charge, you don't make any money off of them, right? So their firms are disciplined by self-help, and they're disciplined by the fear that their workers will quit. Because in a tight labor market, if a key worker quits, you can't staff that job again. This is disciplined by labor. They could also be disciplined by unions, but they haven't been because the union density in tech is terrible. So today we don't have competition. We have regulatory capture, so they don't fear regulators. We have regulatory capture, so self-help measures are off the table, right? Half of web users have installed an ad blocker. Zero app users have installed an ad blocker because it's a felony to reverse engineer an app to create the ad blocker. An app is just a web page wrapped in enough IP to make it a felony to install an ad blocker, right? And they just laid off 12,000 Googlers after doing a stock buyback that would have paid their wages for 27 years. So they're not worried about labor, right? So this is why we are finally getting antitrust, unionization, an acknowledgement of public interest technology and the importance of public interest development of self-help measures. You know, like this is where all this stuff is coming from, is that shorn of any discipline, the corporate sector has alienated everyone who once stood for it with a dwindling minority of people who benefit from it. And they're on the back foot. Now, what comes next could be feudalism, right? Like that's what Varoufakis says. Varoufakis says, Marxists have been predicting the death of capitalism since the Communist Manifesto 150 years ago. And they were wrong over and over, and capitalism reinvented itself as something new whenever it reached a crisis. But maybe capitalism did die this time, and maybe it turned into feudalism. Maybe the thing that we got wrong was not that capitalism would die, but rather that capitalism would die and give way to socialism. Maybe capitalism was a transitional phase between feudalism and feudalism.
God damn it. Right? I had to say that, and I'm so upset because I think, we have dark enlightenment or we can have socialist communist utopia. On that note, though, you have exhausted your time. You have many engagements to get to. You're a wonderful human being. I love talking to you. Come back and do it again.
Oh, well, thank you. It's my pleasure. Okay. I'd love to.
I want to thank Herr Dr. Dr. Professor Dr. Rowe. Or Dr. Of.
Yeah. Or Dr. Of.
Dr. Yeah. Of. Dr. Of what?
Well, Dr. of Law and Dr. of Science is what my doctorates are in.
There you go. I'm going to work on mine. I'm going to get a doctor in something cool like bong rips or something. We'll see.
Right. Well, you can get a Doctor of Divinity from the Universal Life Church for $20.
Okay. I'm going to jump on that. I need
And then you can insist that Germans call you Herr Doctor.
creepy kind
they'll
of
they'll do it.
Well,
Germans get pissed off when people with master's degree don't call themselves magister. They will definitely call you doctor if you get a fake doctorate from what's it, Universal Life Church.
All right, good to know. I'm gonna try that.
All right.
Talk to you next time. All right, be in touch.
All right, talk to you later.